You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Decades ago, Southern California had much dirtier air, more dangerous air, even though fewer people lived here and there were fewer cars on the road. Here's a public service announcement from the era focused on the threat of smog.
California in July. The sun that never quits. It acts on the unburned hydrocarbons and oxides of nitrogen from auto exhausts. Los Angeles County, with 4 million cars, suffers most because it's in a basin. There's nothing to stir up that brown cloud that can make your eyes tear. 85% of it attributed to cars.
In response, in 1967, the state created an agency to study and control air pollution. And by regulation, the air started getting cleaner, mostly because of the ways the state cracked down on car emissions. But there's still a lot of work to be done, including when you factor in more contemporary concerns about climate change. But a new state-of-the-art science lab is opening in the Inland Empire with a mission to find new ways to cut air pollution and find solutions to the climate crisis. Saul Gonzalez is co-host of KQED's The California Report, one of a handful of people to see that lab in operation as it gets ready for its full opening, and Saul filed this report.
With the swipe of a car key that opens a heavy security door, I'm going to the front line of science in California's decades-long war against air pollution.
All right, here we go. Oh, wow.
This has the kind of feel of a, I mean, it's enormous, like an aircraft hangar kind of feel when you walk in for
yes.
the first time.
Yes.
I'm at the California Air Resources Board, or CARB's, new emissions laboratory in Riverside. The size of 6 football fields, this lab, which won't fully open until the summer, is kind of like the NASA of smog research. In the decades to come, it's where the state will study air pollution and test vehicles in all shapes and sizes to make sure they're clean enough to operate on California's roads. CARB spokesperson Linda Lambert is my escort.
So you are in our light duty wing. That's what the LD is. We have 7 test cells, so you're seeing a few of them.
In those test cells, each the size of a big garage, vehicles are hooked up to sensors and are then driven on the automotive equivalent of a treadmill, with their tailpipe emissions captured and analyzed. John Swanton, an air pollution specialist here, speaks to me over the noise of one test in progress for a Nissan Versa.
He's going through a simulated road course, so it's a series of accelerations, decelerations, pauses and idling, and what's happening is emissions are being measured the whole time, and then we're going to get a grams per mile reading of smog-forming emissions.
Even with air quality improvements, those smog-forming emissions still cause over 1,300 premature deaths in the Los Angeles area annually. Beyond cars, this lab also tests a range of other kinds of pollution-spewing machines. From gas-powered lawnmowers to big commercial trucks, which CARB says now make up the single greatest source of smog-forming emissions in the state. That means heavy-duty vehicle emissions testing, from trucks to trains to forklifts, will be a priority of this new lab. Experts have long worried about the health threat those vehicles in particular pose to poor Black and Latino communities living near industrial areas, like the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and warehouses in the Inland Empire. Annette Abair is the deputy executive officer of CARB.
We've realized that these communities suffer more pollution than their neighbors. And so I think this place is going to focus a lot more on that, this new place, a lot more on that heavy-duty element than we could before.
Along with making sure vehicles meet the state's clean air standards, which are tougher than federal standards, CARB emission testers are always on the lookout for possible cheating by vehicle manufacturers. This agency, after all, helped uncover one of the auto industry's biggest environmental scandals.
Today, Volkswagen admitted that it rigged 11 million cars to defraud pollution tests. The U.S. Justice Department is looking into criminal charges.
In 2014 and 15, technicians at CARB's old lab in El Monte, along with researchers in West Virginia and at the US EPA, discovered Volkswagen and other automakers like Mercedes had installed software in their diesel vehicles to deliberately evade accurate emissions testing. The software made it look like cars were polluting way less than they actually were. Dubbed Dieselgate, CARB testing caught Volkswagen red-handed, says Hebert.
VW admitted finally to us after going back and forth with us that they actually did put in some programming that cheated the emission control systems. But once it was discovered, we immediately said, you can't sell these cars.
But CARB's giant new state-of-the-art lab partly exists because of the cheating scandal. As part of a wider settlement with the state of California, VW paid more than $150 million to help build this facility, more than a third of its total cost. As it continues to try to keep car makers honest about how much their vehicles pollute, CARB also asks motorists for their help, reaching out to everyday California drivers to test their vehicles. Mark Fuentes is a lab chief.
It's this Monte Carlo type system where it's just random. We look at the DMV rolls, they randomize the rolls and the ownership, and we'll select, based on population of those vehicles, just a random smattering of those vehicles, bring them in to test to measure the emissions.
Oh, that's interesting. So you will, like, you know, contact John Q. Californian or Jane Q. California
and say, Dear California motorist.
Dear California motorist, we'd like to test your car. Can we have it for a bit of time? And the advantage of that is that's a real-world car that's been out on the streets for some time.
Yes. Right? Yep.
But even as CARB continues its half-century-long fight to cut pollution from internal combustion engines, this lab also has to get ready for some of the biggest changes ever in automotive history, namely the growing popularity of electric vehicles and California's goal of eliminating the sale of all new gas-powered cars in the state by the year 2035, only 12 years away. Annette Hebert says the lab is ready for an electric future.
So this facility is going to be able to test pure electric vehicles, mostly focused on battery durability, because it's not going to do any any good if you got an electric car, the battery only lasts 3 or 4 years. You know, you want it to last 10, 12, 15 years. We want to test to make sure that they have a durable, useful life for the whole life of the electric vehicle.
But Hebert says that even with all the talk about electric cars, gas-powered vehicles will still be on California and LA's roads and freeways for decades to come, meaning the lab's emissions reduction research will remain relevant. Ending our addiction to fossil fuels, Hebert cautions, won't be quick and it won't be easy. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Coming up, I guess you could say that he's pretty much a typecast. Danny Trejo stumbled into the movies and fame after a life of downs and outs. How the Miracle Man found his way, and found his way with food, on the other side of this short break.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
More now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's head to the movies and talk about some jewelry.
Yeah, the diamond. There's a blemish. I can't seem to clean it.
Can it be fixed?
I've tried. I think it's a permanent stain.
Take care of it.
Understood.
Being a tough guy cuts hard. For Danny Trejo, it's all a part of life, a tough life. Born in L.A. in Echo Park, raised and braised in Pacoima, Trejo lived a life on a roller coaster through his teenage years, served some time in prison, almost literally stumbled into the boxing ring on film to start a new life, and things have been looking up ever since. He also wrote books about that life, and he has a new one that shares how food and the family table is a big part of it, called Trejo's Cantina. Danny Trejo, machete, welcome to you.
What's up? How are you? How are you?
Does that describe you, raised and braised in Pacoima?
Yeah, that's about it. Raised, brazen, run out.
Run out. I mean, what a start to your life. And I mentioned the boxing ring because that really is how you got started, right? That was way back in the mid-'80s.
Yeah. I walked onto a movie set of a movie called Runaway Train, and I was helping one of the kids that I was working with, and I was being an extra, and I ran into a guy named Eddie Bunker. Now, Eddie Bunker was in prison with me, and he was the captain's clerk. Now, that is the most powerful job in the institution, because if you get the captain's clerk, the captain to sign something, it happens. So if I had a guard messing with me too much, I could give Eddie $100 and say, hey, move this guy. And all of a sudden, that guard would find himself up on Tower 2, which meant he was there from 12 at night to 6 in the morning. You know, and he wasn't messing with me anymore. And so me and Eddie were like, you know, we're buds. And I ran into him on the set of Runaway Train. And he said, hey, Danny, what are you doing here? I said, I'm hanging out with this kid who wants to stay clean, and they're giving me $50 for acting like a convict. And we laughed because we'd been doing that for free for years. And Eddie had adapted the screenplay when I showed up. He said, hey, we started talking. And then he asked me, are you still boxing, Danny? I go, no, hell, I'm 40 years old. And face can't take anymore. And he said, we need somebody to train one of the actors how to box. And I said, what's it pay? And he said, $320 a day. I said, Eddie, how bad you want this guy beat up? I thought, you know, no, that's a hit. I was a drug counselor. I'm making, you know, that much a month, you know, and he goes, no, you got to be careful. This actor's really high strung. He might sock you. I said, Eddie, for $320, give him a stick. Are you crazy? I've been beat up for free, homie. And
oh, man.
I started training Eric Roberts how to box. I mean, all of a sudden, I was working in movies. I think I did every prison movie from 1985 to 1990.
Obviously, you know, the Machete franchise was a good one for you.
Whoa, look out.
Look out, exactly. But you also get to play funny sometimes.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhat nice, maybe vigilante nice. I want to play a scene from the movie Badass.
I love that.
I'm going to ask you one more time. Anybody know where I can find Terrence?
Who the fuck you think you are, you old motherfucker? Either give me the ball. I'm going to kill your ass.
You know what? I don't hear too good. I messed up my hearing at a Santana concert in 74. Step in here so I can hear you. I can't.
You believe this crazy son of a bitch?
Yo.
And there's a lot of fighting and punching and crunching and everything else that's going on. But you know, again, you're trying to maybe help a few people, too.
Everything good that has happened to me has happened as a direct result of helping someone else. Everything. I did a favor for the director of the movie Badass. It was like a really low budget movie. And he needed a name. And he said, well, yeah. So my agent booked me for that. And we went and did it. It turned into a trilogy. And plus I met a producer named Ash Shaw, who saw that I eat good food. I don't like the jacket. I don't like the Mickey. I don't like processed food. I'll eat good. And on a low budget movie, I'll usually take a tuna salad or something and make it at home and take it with me. And I met Ash and he said, Danny, you eat really well. I said, yeah, I have to. I'm 79 years old. Well, I was just only 75 then. 75. Yeah. And he said,
Whippersnapper back then.
Yeah. He said, why don't you open a restaurant? And jokingly, I said, Trejo's Tacos. He brought a business plan, and I opened it and looked at it, and the first page didn't have no killing, so I gave it to Gloria, my agent, and she said, it's a no-brainer. This is the first time somebody's given you a business plan and don't want $100,000 up front.
So that's where Trejo's Tacos was born.
That's what was it. And we got, you know, we've got like five of them right now. We're opening up one in Detroit, and... Wow. with like the House of Blues, because I started a record label and now I got singers and bands, and then we're opening up one in London.
You put your finger on food, right? Let's talk about food for a second, because you really, well, you managed to get across.
Remember that. Fight night nachos.
I want to try the tacos. I want to, and the nachos, and I also want to try the donuts. But we'll get to that in a moment. I do want to talk about your love of food and taking care of people, right? And the way you make it feel in this book is so thoughtful and warm. One story that stuck out to me was about making food when you were at San Quentin. And yeah. I wonder if you could read just a quick moment from that piece.
If a bunch of cons can make a concrete table in a maximum security penitentiary feel like a party, imagine what you can do in your kitchen if you treat every meal, whether it's breakfast, lunch, or dinner, like a celebration of life. Like all the people that get visits on the weekend, they go and they're having, you know, lunch with their families. All us guys that were been in the penitentiary forever and, you know, had no family anymore, they kind of like have to like make themselves feel good in a bad situation. You know, you're thinking about your wife, your kids, your mom, and so how do we do it? It's like everybody brings a little something and we mix it up together, call it a spread. And so you learn how to mix this with this and mix that with this. And we stole this out of the kitchen and you have a good meal. And that's what food is. And for me, when people come into my restaurant, I want them to feel like they're in the living room. All my staff is like, they leave all their problems at home. We don't got no hearty har-hars. We got all, you know, hi, how are you? You know, just people that are just friendly. And
is that what a gathering at the Trejo House looks like when you have people over and you want to feed them?
Oh, God. Here, when we have the fights, there's usually like 30 people, and we got TVs and a big screen outside. And we have, like Trejo's tacos, and we have a pretty big spread during the summer.
You're doing an event with Live Talks tomorrow, right? What you going to talk about at Live Talks?
Probably more the book, Trejo's Cantina, or Trejo, My Life of Crime, Redemption, in Hollywood. That's my memoir.
A memoir. Well, I just want to say, Danny Trejo, Machete, I am honored to speak with you, my friend. And to tell you the truth, I mean, your life is an inspiration to so many other people, too, to know that you can overcome adversity. And to find new lives and new corners that you can turn and make new things happen in your life. So I want to thank you, congratulate you on the new book. Danny Trejo, thank you for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you so much, man. And come on down to the restaurant.
By the way, if you want more info on Danny's reading at Live Talks LA tomorrow night, check out our website at kcrw.com/GLA for a link to that event. More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. An asphalt plant has been making a big stink down in Orange County. In the Irvine neighborhood of Orchard Hills, complaints have been racking up for years about the All-American Asphalt Factory, which residents say spews pollution and smelly chemicals that are ruining their quality of life. Well, now city leaders have approved a plan to shut it down, but the land could be really contaminated, and nobody knows how much time or money it's going to take to clean it up. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the LA Times, one of our regulars, of course, here on GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Paint the picture for us about Orchard Hills, right? It's on the northern side of Irvine. What's it like there?
Orchard Hills actually is one of the newer developments in Irvine, going back to just about 2014, built by the Irvine Company, which historically has been the biggest developer in the city. And since it's so far up in the reaches of Irvine, it's going to places that planners even 30 years ago never thought would have housing there. Hence, now you have Orchard Hills up against this All-American Asphalt that was only built there in the 1990s.
So give us a background on this asphalt plant. What kind of problems has it been causing for residents?
There was no problems. I mean, it basically operated for 20 years. Then Orchard Hills, which is basically less than a mile away over a ridge from All-American Asphalt, residents start moving in there around the mid-2010s, after 2014. No matter if you're close to anything that's spewing any sort of smoke or anything, it's got a smell. So residents, of course, immediately said, hey, Irvine, we can't deal with this. Like, this is not cool for us. This is ruining our quality of life. We're afraid that it could possibly be harming our children and ourselves. So they asked the city to do some tests. The city says, I don't really see anything. And besides, it's the problem, the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which has cited All-American Asphalt for contaminants over the years. And the city, though, said it's not really our issue. But finally, residents pushed enough to make it an issue in Irvine.
And so the city now is going to buy it back. Is that correct? And how much is that going to cost? And what does it want to do with that property?
Yeah, this is extraordinary about Irvine. They're going to pay $285 million to shut down this asphalt plant, which, wow, most cities are wondering, like, we wish we even had $10 million to buy one lot, especially a lot of the cities in Northern Orange County. And the interesting thing about this is because there's so much animosity between All-American Asphalt and the city of Irvine, the city has to put down a down payment of $28.5 million that's non-refundable. They have not been able to even inspect the land to see what, if any, contamination they're going to have to clean up afterwards. And so the city council, they bought this land even as they saying, yeah, maybe we're going to buy a big, huge lemon. But hey, we have the insurance to bail us out just in case it is a big, fat lemon.
All right. So, I mean, there's a chance that the city may not be able to do anything with it. It could be a lemon, as you say. What is the ideal situation? Do they want to develop it? Do they want to build more of those tract homes that you keep talking about? I mean, what's the plan?
What the city wants to do ultimate is something that they call the Gateway Preserve. So you get the land around what's right now All-American Asphalt and surrounding it. Then they would connect it with 300 other acres of open space that's already in Irvine. So in total, the city would have around that area 700 acres of open space. And that's what Irvine has always been telling its residents over the decades. Like, yeah, we're going to build all this housing, but we're also going to keep some land open preserve forever. But of course, this is Irvine. This is Orange County. There's always that demand for more housing, especially Irvine, which draws so many people for its education, for its neighborhoods are a little bit too pleasant and placid for me, but a lot of other people want it. So I could see eventually some part of it becoming housing. I mean, look at the Great Park. You'll remember the Great Park. It was promised as this Orange County's version of Central Park, and immediately the city starts selling off parts of it to create the Great Park neighborhoods.
How are locals feeling about all of this with the plant? I mean, they've been complaining about it for a long time, and now the city's, you know, being forced into action. But it still feels like there's some ambiguity here.
I mean, at the very least, residents are saying that there's not going to be any more asphalt being produced, which means there's not going to be any more smoke, which means the quality of air is going to improve. And again, this is Orchard Hills, that one neighborhood in Irvine. For the rest of Orange County, they don't care. But I also think it's a really interesting case study in how, you know, because we talk so much about environmental racism, usually it happens to working class communities whose voices are not heard for years, if not decades. Here in Irvine, the voices of the residents of Orchard Hills were not listened to for a little bit, but they're also more wealthier than, say, Anaheim or Santana. So eventually their will was done, because in Irvine, you could only anger residents for so long before there's political repercussions. And here we are.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, off to the Queen Mary we go. The near-century-old luxury ocean liner has been anchored off Long Beach since the late 1960s. It's open for visitors again, but it needs a lot of work. What kind of work? And who's going to pay for it? That's tomorrow on GLA. Share what's on your mind. What kind of work are you doing? Maybe there's a story we should talk about and explore more deeply. Check us out at kcrw.com/GLA. Grab the podcast, too, while you're there. And, of course, get that podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all help put the show together. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the time and, of course, that ear. Have a great night.